for gravitational waves, and it's the search for periodic gravitational waves. So I have the impression that that people probably hear more often about transient gravitational wave events, gravitational wave bursts, and binary end spirals. And I'll be talking about a method from stochastic background searching that we've tailored to look for periodic signals. Quite a lot of the talk is actually going to be an overview of gravitational wave searches in general. I figured that here I could talk about relativity, but Chad assures me that you've not all been bored by innumerable talks on gravitational waves. So I have a first part of the talk where I'll talk about the gravitational wave observations in general. So gravitation, how they propagate, how they're generated, and then how we plan to detect them. Then I'll describe the cross-correlation method, first as it was developed in searches for a random background of gravitational waves, and then the more recent application to periodic gravitational wave signals, and how this this sort of method can be tuned. You can trade off sensitivity for computing time by choosing what data you want to cross-correlate. And then I'll just say a few words at the end about some specific applications of this that are being developed and tested now to look for young neutron stars and to look for accreting neutron stars in low-mass X-ray binaries. These both fall in the category of so-called targeted gravitational wave searches, where we know a sky location where there's an interesting object, but we don't know things like the frequency with which the gravitational waves will be oscillating. So first, gravitational waves themselves, I have what I like to call my cocktail party explanation of why there have to be gravitational waves, which is basically if you take action at a distance from Newtonian gravity and you mix in the principles of causality from relativity, you're necessarily led to a conclusion that something has to happen. There's some way that information has to propagate no faster than the speed of light. So the sort of cartoon idea is that you could imagine an object that has a Newtonian gravitational field that it generates, and you've got all these field lines pointing towards the object. And if I suddenly move the object somewhere else, then the gravitational field will change. The action at a distance that it exerts will change. And if you take Newtonian gravity literally, one literal interpretation is to say that, well, the field lines all point to the instantaneous position of the object. But we know in relativity that can't be right, because otherwise I could take a massive object and start moving it around, and I could use that to send a signal to someone arbitrarily far away by just having them measure the change in gravitational field of that object. So information about how I've moved objects cannot propagate through the gravitational field any faster than the speed of light. And so this is sort of a cartoon of moving an object back and forth and then watching its imprint in the gravitational field ripple out at the speed of light. The mathematical grounding for this, of course, is in general relativity, where you replace the geometry of space-time, you replace the Flatt-Minkowski metric with a general metric that obeys Einstein's equations. And I have to say it's a little embarrassing to be giving the strong gravity seminar, because I'm going to talk about a regime where it's by definition weak gravity. Certainly in the regime where you are imagining gravitational waves propagating and interacting then with our detectors, the imprint of the gravitational waves is considered to be a small perturbation on top of the background metric, which for simplicity I'll take to be the Flatt-Minkowski metric. So, of course, when the gravitational waves are generated, that can be in a strong field regime, although we also have sort of weak field approximations for that that are useful for getting a handle on what the gravitational waves look like. And so it's convenient to describe gravitational waves in the so-called transverse traceless gauge, where you use the gauge freedom to make the temporal components of the metric perturbation and its divergence and its trace all go to zero. And this gauge is convenient for two reasons. The one that's probably better known is that the vacuum Einstein equations then just turn into wave equations for the components of the metric. So the non-zero components of this metric perturbation H obey a sort of ordinary speed of light wave equation in the Flatt-Minkowski background. An additional property which is useful for understanding how gravitational waves are measured is that if you have a test particle sitting at constant coordinate location in this gauge, in this transverse traceless gauge, that is following a GAD6. So that's a freely falling test particle. Sometimes the picture gets a little muddled when you think about the gravitational wave goes by and it moves the objects around. Well, whether the objects are moving or not depends on what coordinate system you're describing them in. And actually, if you describe it in the transverse traceless gauge, their coordinate positions aren't changing, but the distances between them, which are measurable, are changing. And this is usually written in a convenient coordinate system at a convenient basis. If you imagine that you're far away from the gravitational wave source, you've got a plane wave propagating along. And what the way one usually talks about what the meaningful components of the metric perturbation are is to say, well, let's suppose the gravitational wave is propagating in the z direction, and then it's going to be in the x and y segment of the h mu nu tensor that everything's going to be happening. And so in these special coordinates, because this thing is transverse, there are no z components of the metric perturbation. And because it's traceless, because it's symmetric and traceless, the only independent there's only two independent components, which are the ones on the diagonal and the ones off the diagonal. And so this is a general solution to the wave equation if these two functions, h plus and h cross, are functions of t minus z over c. So this is not x cubed. This is the third component of the vector. And so it's usually written down in this kind of coordinate system. The problem is, of course, this is not always the coordinate system you want to use to do all of physics, and so you want to write this down in more of a coordinate free way. Because of the transverse traceless gauge, we can actually write everything in sort of three-dimensional vector notation. You know, the temporal components of this thing don't exist. We've got this flat Minkowski background, and so it's very convenient to work in terms of three-dimensional vectors and three-dimensional tensors. This same thing here, where you've got h plus and h cross as components or elements of this matrix representing the metric perturbation, those can also be thought of as the non-zero components of tensor metric perturbation. And then there's two basis tensors, e plus and e cross. Those are multiplying. And in this special basis, those are just, you know, e plus is just 1 and minus 1 on the diagonal, and e cross is 1's off the diagonal. But if we write it in this coordinate independent way, it prevents us from having to do a bunch of unnecessary coordinate rotations to calculate things. So we just remember that you're actually just taking inner products of vectors and tensors. And so in this coordinate free notation, these e plus and e cross, I like to think of them in terms of dyad products of unit vectors. So you can understand this basis if the wave is propagating out of the board at you along this k vector. You pick two vectors perpendicular to that. You get an orthonormal Cartesian basis, and then you use those L and M unit vectors to construct the plus and cross basis tensors. And I actually also like to sort of draw these pictures where I've got, you know, the arrows outward here along L mean that the sort of, you know, the LL components of E plus are positive, and the inward pointing ones here along M say that, you know, the MM components of E plus are negative. And so this is sort of a nice geometrical. I haven't been able to draw a geometrical picture of an arbitrary tensor, but at least for symmetric tensors, I can represent them like this. But of course, the choice of these two perpendicular vectors, these two vectors perpendicular to a propagation direction, that's arbitrary. You can choose any vector in the plane perpendicular to K to be your L. And so if you want to describe which polarization basis you're using, there's an additional piece of information, which is where in the plane is that vector L. And this is usually parameterized by a so-called polarization angle, which we write as psi. So you pick some reference direction, like an arrow pointing west on the sky in the direction of decreasing right ascension, and then you say the angle around from that to where you defined your polarization basis. That's the polarization angle psi. And so this polarization basis, E plus and E cross, if you want to sort of say what you need to construct that, you need a propagation direction for the signal, which means if you're thinking about a signal coming from somewhere in the sky, you need it to write ascension and declination, and then you also need the polarization angle just to define which polarization basis it was you chose, which vector you started with to make that. And so these are, this is general done for convenience of For modeled signals, it tends to be for convenience of the signal. And so, for example, if you're thinking about a binary system, you'd kind of like the binary orbital plane to be somehow lined up with this vector L. And similarly, if you are looking at a rotating neutron star, the rotation axis of the neutron star, its projection onto the sky is parallel to the vector M. So a source often tells you what its preferred polarization basis is, and then you can think of this polarization angle psi as being the angle necessary to pick out the source's preferred polarization basis. Okay, so I've already started talking about sources then, so that brings me to the next part of the crash course in gravitational wave physics, which is how gravitational waves are generated. As I said, you move masses around, and that generates gravitational waves. And because of various conservation laws, the lowest multipole you get in a multipole expansion is a quadrupole. And so this is sort of not the notation I was using, but it was the quickest way to write down the quadrupole formula. But basically, you want to think about what is the second derivative of the quadrupole moment tensor, or the second derivative of the moment of inertia of the mass distribution. Project that into this transverse traceless basis, and then that is related to the metric perturbation that you see. And so a classic example of a kind of oscillating quadrupole moment would be just a binary system in orbit, because then while the magnitude of the inertia tensor remains the same, if the orbits are stable, then the orientation of it changes around, and so the individual components of the quadrupole moment tensor will be changing. And so I have some cartoons that all use a binary of things just orbiting each other indefinitely, and the math is the same for the signal from that as from the signal from a rotating neutron star with some sort of non-axisymmetric deformation on it, which are actually the signals that I'm thinking about in the context of this work. But it's easier to draw the pictures of the binary, so I'll do that. Now, of course, there's a radiation reaction feedback, in particular in the orbiting binary system. As these objects orbit around, they give off gravitational waves that takes energy out of the orbits, and they inspiral. I'm not drawing that in these cartoons, but that's the famous example of indirect confirmation of gravitational waves in the binary pulsar, where the orbital evolution exactly lines up with what you'd expect due to energy loss from gravitational radiation. So you're both sitting close enough that you can see these animations, I hope. This illustrates actually both the metric perturbation generated by an oscillating mass distribution and the effect that you would use to measure it. So this is an example of actually choosing this polarization basis conveniently. This is a situation where you've got a binary of, and I drew this picture for equal mass objects, and you're seeing the orbit edge on. So that's why you're just seeing these things moving back and forth, as you're looking edge on in the binary orbit. And so the natural way to line up your plus and cross polarizations is to have the directions for your plus polarization be parallel and perpendicular to that projected orbital plane. And so you get a gravitational wave. So this dashed line is supposed to be the position of unperturbed test masses. And as the wave goes by, it changes the distance between them. And so, again, in the TT gauge, they're not actually moving, but the distance between them is changing. And so as the gravitational wave, as different phases of the gravitational wave pass by, you're seeing distance between objects in the vertical direction oscillating and likewise in the horizontal direction oscillating. And because this is seen edge on, this is what's called linear polarization. And if you break up the polarization basis in this way, if you line up your basis tensors conveniently, you get no contribution in the cross polarization. On the other hand, if you're seeing the binary face on, then any resolution you do is going to have equal amplitudes in the plus and cross polarizations. And so this picture here, it's got sorry, I'm having some weird parallax effect when I look at the screen here. But in this picture, you've got a plus polarization oscillating in the same way, where the sort of up-down and left-right distances are oscillating. And a quarter of a cycle out of phase with that, you've got the same thing happening in the in the cross-polarization, where different distances in these diagonal directions are changing sinusoidally. And so when you superimpose these two effects, you actually get this nice picture of this kind of rotating deformed ellipsoid. Rotating deformed ellipse. So I was sort of happy when I was able to make that as a cartoon, because I haven't tried to make it with my hands. Like, imagine what it's got to be if you're seeing it edge-on or face-on. So the most general case, you have both plus and cross polarizations, if you're seeing the orbit at sort of an oblique angle, then if you've chosen your polarization basis conveniently, you have plus and cross oscillations, which are, again, a quarter of a cycle out of phase, but the plus oscillation is a higher amplitude. Okay, so that was an example of a signal with a fairly simple signal model, where you just had a perpetually oscillating quadrupole moment. And that actually falls into one of the four categories that we normally define different types of gravitational wave signals into, that of periodic sources. So that's something where there is a simple signal model, which is this sinusoidal signal, and it goes on for a long time. And that's also actually the way that, for example, white dwarf binaries behave in the frequency band of whatever space-based gravitational wave detector will eventually be launched. However, binary orbits at frequencies that are relevant to ground-based detectors, so tens of hertz to thousands of hertz, those are binaries of black holes and neutron stars. And it turns out that those, in the timescale that you watch them, will evolve very quickly. So they'll actually give off gravitational radiation very quickly, and they'll undergo this coalescence within a period of time of typically seconds to minutes. And so you're thinking of seeing gravitational waves from transient signals, but for which are still well modeled. There are other kinds of modeled signals, but binary coalescence are the most famous of them. You can also think about looking for unmodeled signals. You can look for something that just goes bang. You look for gravitational waves from a non-spherically symmetric supernova explosion, some sort of a black hole merger that is in some weird part of parameter space, so that you don't have a really good waveform for it. Soft gamma repeaters. There are a number of different things, and also things that we haven't thought of could generate unmodeled bursts. You could also think about having a superposition of a whole bunch of signals, either astrophysical signals or things from the early universe, that would give a random signal, a random gravitational wave strain that's hitting our detectors. And that gives what's known as a stochastic background signal. And that gives you a random signal in each detector. But all those random signals are determined from the same, random gravitational wave tensor. So there are correlations among the signals that would show up in different detectors. And so again, it's this top row that are of interest for the search that I'm focusing on today. To look for signals from a stochastic background, you use a cross-correlation method to try to look for those correlations in the random signals that show up in both detectors that are buried under random uncorrelated noise. And that technique can also be used to look for periodic sources, but there you can benefit by adding information about the signal itself, so adding signal model information. Let's see, so this is some snapshots of this cartoon. Again, as a gravitational wave goes by, it changes the distances between freely falling particles in perpendicular directions. And so the way that the current generation of gravitational wave detectors measure this is with interferometry. So if you've got a wave coming by with this quadrupolar pattern that's changing distances in one direction out of phase with distances in a perpendicular direction, a good way to measure that effect is to use interferometry to very carefully measure, very precisely measure the difference between two distances. And so if you sort of work out what that looks like in linearized gravity, you'll find that if you choose now a different coordinate system which lines up with the arms of the detector, then in that coordinate system you're basically looking at hxx minus hyy, and that picks out the plus polarization if the wave happened to be coming directly perpendicular to the plane of the detector. But again, this is in a particular convenient coordinate system, and if you want to sort of translate between that and the picture of the wave propagating in a particular direction, rather than doing a bunch of coordinate rotations on your tensors, what you should really do is look at the whole thing in a coordinate independent picture. And so that picture, you say that, well, this metric perturbation tensor is contracted with a response tensor defining the geometry of the detector. And I should say also, this is my theorist's cartoon. I think this is my bona fide effort for giving a talk at an Institute for Theoretical Physics. The first time I drew this cartoon, I put the beam splitter backwards. And so the laser went, hit the beam splitter, and then went directly into the photodetector instead of being sent down the arms of the interferometer. So that's true. I mean, half of the light went directly in, and then half would actually go down the other one. That's true. This is the experimentalist cartoon of the same thing and describes other experimental techniques, like the fact that the photons actually bounce back and forth down the arms a bunch of times before we observe them. These techniques enable us to measure ridiculously small differences in distance on the order of 10 to the minus 18 meters, and that makes it even feasible to try to see gravitational waves coming from violent events. It's always good in this sort of talk to also have pictures of gravitational wave observatory sites. So these are the four large-scale active ground-based gravitational wave detectors. There are the two that are collectively known as LIGO that have arms that are 4 kilometers long, one in Washington State and one in Louisiana. There's Virgo with 3 kilometer arms in Italy. And these three observatories all have sort of comparable design sensitivity. The GEO-600 detector in Germany has shorter arms and is more of a sort of development facility for technologies for future generations of gravitational wave detectors. So Virgo is an degree angle. That is an optical illusion. However, GEO is not at right angles. The angle between the GEO arms is 97 degrees. Geography, I think it wasn't convenient to build the arms in those directions. It turns out that in this same long wave, those really are perpendicular. It's just
that's not how they're supposed to work. But
it might be like a fisheye lens or something, even on the Yeah, I suppose I should get a picture of Virgo that where the arms look like they're perpendicular. Yeah, so they're certainly not less than 90 degrees. Like I said, for GEO, they're slightly more than 90 degrees. It looks almost like a triangle. It's almost like they tried to make LISA or Einstein telescope or something. Observatory. We consider this the first generation of ground-based gravitation. So the first generation of kilometer-scale interferometric gravitational wave detector. I suppose you could say that there were sort of zeroth generations in terms of prototype interferometers and cryogenic bar detectors, and then -1 generations of room temperature bar detectors. But the family that we're interested in at the moment is the kilometer-scale gravitational wave interferometric gravitational wave detectors, So the ones that are going on now are operated by two collaborations that are in collaboration with each other. The LIGO Scientific Collaboration deals with data from the two LIGO observatories and also from GEO, although, as I said, the GEO data themselves don't feature very prominently in the gravitational wave searches. I mentioned that there was a Hanford Observatory and Livingston Observatory. Hanford also in the first generation of gravitational wave detectors, Hanford had two arms, two interferometers in the same site. One of them 2 kilometers long and one of them 4 kilometers long. The 2 kilometer interferometer was actually dismantled a couple of years ago, and so in fact that's not the situation anymore, and that won't be exactly the situation in the second generation either. The Virgo collaboration is a separate collaboration, but they are now have an agreement with the LIGO Scientific Collaboration that we analyze our data together. And so it means that we really do have a network of gravitational wave detectors at three or four sites in the first generation. And there have been six LIGO science runs, but the first four of these were fairly short, you know, on the period of sort of weeks to maybe a couple of months, and they were also not at the design sensitivity. So they were sort of between each run, they would do commissioning and improve the sensitivity. And the run that LIGO was really built for was this S5 run. And so this was the run done at basically design sensitivity, and this is actually the detector that's called initial LIGO, the one that ran for 2 years in S5. Virgo started their first science run towards the end of that, not quite at their design sensitivity, but it was the beginning of these joint LIGO-Virgo analyses. And after this S5 VSR one run, there was some more commissioning. They figured out that they could actually get a little more sensitivity out of the LIGO detectors, and we've just had this S6 run that finished last year that was a little bit shorter, but still more than a year. And this is actually referred to as enhanced LIGO, because they did some technological advancements to get a little more sensitivity out of it. And Virgo had their second and third science runs, and their second science run was actually very close to their design sensitivity as well. So this is usually described in terms of this sensitivity is described in terms of the amplitude spectral density of the noise. So most of the signals in these detectors is noise, and it comes from a number of different sources, but the dominant ones are seismic noise at low frequencies, some sort of thermal noise in the middle. This is actually more theoretical than the way it turned out, and then shot noise, just counting photons at high frequencies. And so you have this typical shape where there tends to be a steeper loss of sensitivity at low frequencies and a more shallow one at higher frequencies. And so this is from the S5 and VSR1 run, and this shows the sensitivity of the different detectors. So you see the blue and green are the 2 4-kilometer LIGOs. The blue is the shorter LIGO, which is less sensitive because you're looking for fractional changes in shorter arms, and so the fractional change you can see is less. And then Virgo, as you see, its design sensitivity is this black dotted dashed curve, and so it's really not quite there yet at most frequencies in the VSR1 run. And then this S6 VSR2, Virgo really did get to its design sensitivity on its best days over a wide range of frequencies, and LIGO, you see, is actually a little better than it was originally designed to be. Virgo has a more sophisticated seismic isolation. It's actually the technology that they'll be using in the second generation of advanced LIGO. They have these sort of very tall inverted pendulum isolation. So yeah, and in fact, this is, I don't think this is on any of my slides, but this is a big deal because if you're looking for gravitational waves from a known pulsar, right, then you know that the object is rotating. And you know that it should be giving off gravitational waves at twice the rotation frequency, because you're looking for an oscillating quadrupole moment. It's actually twice the rotation frequency that matters. And so the Crab pulsar is rotating at about 30 hertz, and so its gravitational wave signal should be at 60 hertz, inconveniently close to the power, but the AC power, but it's not exactly 60, and it turns out that you can do a long enough Fourier transform that you can resolve that from the 60 hertz line. Yes. So some of these spikes are easily identified and some are not. But yeah, there's a spike here at 60 hertz. There's another spike at 120 hertz. So there are spikes at all the harmonics of 60 hertz for LIGO and 50 hertz for Virgo. Yeah, you can actually see here. Here's the 50 hertz AC line in Europe and the 60 hertz in the US. This often ends up being the people want to know about what are all the spikes and bumps on this curve. What I was going to say is that for the it's not quite at 60 hertz, so that's something else. I mean, there in addition to the AC power, there's lots of other things that cause instrumental lines, and that's actually if you're just doing a blind search for rotating neutron stars, you have to catalog what all the instrumental lines are, and a lot of those are sort of found empirically, it's fortunately, if there's a real gravitational wave signal, it's actually Doppler modulated by the Earth's rotation and orbital motion. And so, in fact, these instrumental lines often look like gravitational waves from pulsars that are in a particular direction for which there's no Doppler shift at the moment. Like, you know, it's perpendicular to the Earth's instantaneous motion. You tend to sort of get signals that are attributable to instrumental lines. What I was going to say is that the Vela pulsar actually rotates slowly enough that its signal will be lost in the seismic wall. I actually forget the frequency off the top of my head, but it's basically below that. This 40 hertz is really the sort of LIGO seismic cutoff. And so you have the Vela pulsar that's actually down here around 30 hertz or so. And so that's something where Virgo can look for this, but it's beyond the reach of initial LIGO. Advanced LIGO will have better seismic isolation, and we'll see more into sort of the teens, and will be where its seismic cutoff will be. So, yes, for known pulsars, because you also see them spinning down, you can see their rotation, you can see their spin down, you can set an indirect limit on how much gravitational radiation they can be giving off. You can basically say if all of the observed spin down were due to gravitational radiation, it would be of this amplitude. And for most known pulsars, that level of gravitational wave signal is below what can be detected with the current detectors. The Crab pulsar is actually the first pulsar for which this so-called spin-down limit was beaten. And so from initial from S5 observations with LIGO, we can say that no more than 2% of the energy loss associated with the Crab spin-down can be in gravitational radiation. Now, the Crab is most accessible because it's a fairly young neutron star, and so it's spinning down pretty fast. And so, in fact, we wouldn't expect that it would be spinning down due to gravitational radiation, but it's something that can't be ruled out by this spin-down limit. The Vela pulsar is sort of the second thing that you could get that, the second thing for which you could beat the spin-down limit, but you need to use Virgo to do it because it's a too low a frequency to be seen by LIGO. So expect or can not rule out by the node?
No, the frequency, right? You know, the distance, I don't know.
The question is whether it has a point on it.
Yeah,
it
depends.
I mean, where on this vertical line is.
So it's a bit tricky to draw the line like this because the thing is that this is. So this is in units of strain per root hertz because it's actually the square root of the power spectral density for a random signal, whereas the periodic signals from pulsars will have a fixed amplitude. And so the thing you actually plot is in strain and not strain per root hertz for them. And you also have
assuming
to
certain energy resolution, you can still blow up here, right?
But I mean, they don't know what.
The limits can be set, and the limits that you set are limits on this ellipticity, limits on what the non-axis symmetric deformation can be. But it's also translated into this, you have to make an assumption about how long you're observing for as well, because it's not. Sorry, you wouldn't see it just in the raw data. What you would see is that by observing, by doing coherent observation for a long time, you can pick out the signal. So both for continuous waves and stochastic signals, you gain sensitivity with observing time. I don't have that plot here for known pulsars, although I have a plot later on, which is again. Parallel to the noise curve that compares an indirect limit for supernova 1987A to the level of gravitational radiation we could detect with initial LIGO data. Let's see. Oh, so the advertisement. I don't really have any more bullet points about this, but LIGO is actually not operating now and won't be for a few years because it's begun the upgrade to advanced LIGO. And so they're basically swapping out all the equipment. They're going to have the same, you know, physical facilities, but they're going to have all, you know, new mirrors and new lasers and everything. And Virgo will be doing that later this year. They've got sort of one more run this summer. They'll be doing it in coincidence with GEO. But basically on the order of sort of 2014 or so, you should expect to start seeing news from advanced detectors going online and getting ready to take their science data. We still have, there are still analyses of S5 and S6 data which are ongoing. Most of the results from S5 have now been released, and some of the results from S6, but there are things that are sort of propagating through analysis and internal review. And there are also techniques which are being developed and, you know, being tested on the best data we have, which are S5 and S6 data. So in fact, the techniques that are at the end of these slides are things which are being tested on initial and enhanced LIGO and Virgo data, but will probably end up you know, being potential production analyses for advanced detector data. Okay, so I think I'll probably just manage to say a few things about the method for a specific kind of search that I have on the docket today, and that is this cross-correlation method. So that's a method which was developed in the context of a stochastic background and has been used to look for to look for periodic gravitational waves from an interesting direction where we don't have the full signal model. And we've made some enhancements to this technique to allow it to be used to search for periodic gravitational waves when we know something but not everything about the signal. So first of all, where this was first used in gravitational wave searches was in a search for a stochastic background. So as I mentioned, most of the output, you know, the data stream from a gravitational wave detector is actually noise of various sorts. And you're looking for a weak signal that's on top of that noise. And so you're using some property of that signal to pull it out from the noise. And this signal is, again, constructed geometrically by taking this metric perturbation tensor and contracting it onto a tensor describing the geometry of the detector. And so if I say, what happens if I look for the expected cross-correlation between two data streams, we do this in the Fourier domain, as we do with a number of our analyses, and we can say, well, okay, I expect that the data in Louisiana and the data in Washington are not going to be correlated with each other. I mean, I'm looking for, you know, certainly things like the photon counting shot noise, and, you know, there are different lasers that we're doing, you know, thermal noise are in different thermal environments. Even seismic noise, they're in different enough seismic environments and they're far enough away from each other that you would expect that, you know, you'd get correlations associated with maybe the speed of sound between them. And so you still shouldn't expect to see those sorts of noise correlations. Now, of course, for the data from the two Hanford instruments, when we had two instruments running at Hanford, this was a big question, was could you look for correlations in those, and would you, you know, just have to assume that any of those were due to the fact that they're in the same environment? But we'll be focusing on looking at correlations in the data for detectors at different sites. And so the underlying assumption is that the noise part of the data streams will average to zero, their correlation will average to zero over time. And similarly, on average, the instrumental noise component should be uncorrelated with the gravitational wave signal itself. And so the expected cross-correlation, the expectation value of that should be just given by the expectation value of the cross-correlation between the data in the two detectors, the gravitational wave contribution. If we're looking for a stochastic background, that's also treated as random. And so the way that we can pick a random signal out from on top of random noise is to look for correlations in multiple detectors. And so sort of formally, geometrically, you can imagine it in terms of some sort of hairy object with four indices that gets contracted into both detector tensors. But when you work out what that means for particular pairs of detectors, this is usually described in the stochastic background in terms of an expected cross-correlation at a given frequency, which is made up of two things. One is the a sort of measure of the spectral strength of the gravitational wave signal, and the other is a geometry factor, which in the stochastic background search is called the overlap reduction function. And so if you like, the spectral properties of the gravitational wave background signal you're looking for are encoded in this SGW part of the expected cross-correlation, and the geometry is encoded in the gamma 1-2 in the overlap reduction function. And so you can do a search for gravitational waves by putting together an optimally filtered cross-correlation statistic. You weight the correlations at different frequencies by an optimal filter, and you put in the optimal filter based for the kind of signal that you're looking for. So you put in the expected shape of the gravitational wave signal, whether it could be sort of uniform energy with frequency, it could be uniform signal strength with frequency. There's different choices you can make. And also, assumptions about the spatial distribution of sources on the sky lead to this overlap reduction function. So the simplest thing is to assume that there is a superposition of gravitational waves coming from all directions with equal strengths, and that gives you an isotropic overlap reduction function. That's what's been used for most of the stochastic background searches done with LIGO data so far. But you can also look for different spherical harmonic modes besides the L equals 0 and M equals 0 one, and you can also look for signals coming from a particular direction on the sky. This is sometimes referred to as the gravitational wave radiometer, which I'll use scare quotes for because I don't like that name very much. But it's this is basically putting in the information that we assume there's a gravitational wave coming from one particular point in the sky, but it's some random gravitational wave coming from that point. So either, you know, it's somehow a superposition of many different processes that are happening, or it's just something that we don't know well enough, and so we're treating it as random. So that is actually built into this overlap reduction function. So that this is a complex quantity, and so there's a phase, there's a contribution to the phase that's associated with propagation along that direction between the two detectors.
Do you need more very precise distance, or is it always?
Not especially. So we're in this. Most of what we're looking for is in a long wavelength regime, where you can assume that the entire, you know, the detector is this object that's sort of 4 kilometers in each direction, in some sense, and you can assume that you're seeing the same phase of the gravitational wave of the whole detector. This starts to come in. So you get corrections that start to come in at like a 5 or 10% level at. Excuse me. They come in at like a 5 to 10% level at 1 kilohertz, and so it's really in the higher frequencies you need to start making corrections, and they have to make corrections to a lot of assumptions. Even just the assumption that you can project onto a single detector tensor, that's based on the assumption that you're making an instantaneous measurement of distance changes. And so, for high enough frequency gravitational waves, you have to worry about the fact that as the photons propagate through your detector, the gravitational wave phase is changing. And so there you do have to put in some, you have to basically do a more careful calculation to say, like, okay, you know, what is the actual round-trip photon time down the arm and things like that. But for the most part, for the frequencies we're most interested in and where we're most sensitive, which is sort of like, you know, 200 hertz or so, you can neglect that. You can assume it's the same phase of gravitational wave at the whole detector. And in fact, at low enough frequencies, you actually get the data that hit the different detectors are... like a fraction of a cycle apart. But for, you know, for frequencies of a few hundred hertz, you do have to worry about, you know, exactly what direction the waves came from. And so that's, in fact, how this so-called radiometer search for point-like sources was done. There was a sky map made that said, let's, you know, take every possible direction on the sky and look for random gravitational waves coming from there. As you can imagine, that sort of, you know, that takes a sensitivity hit from the fact that you have a lot of independent measurements, and so you have a trials factor of a few hundred. But if you have some particular interesting directions on the sky, like the galactic center or Scorpius X1, the brightest non-solar X-ray source in the sky, you may say, well, let's look at that separately, and let's consider that to be a measurement. And so the measurement that I'm interested in today is to say, you know, we've got a known sky location. and we're looking for a nearly monochromatic signal, but we'll look at, we don't know what frequency it's at, so we'll look at different frequencies, and we won't try to make any, so the original search didn't try to make any assumptions about the model of this, and you know, what the long-term properties of it were. And so this is a method that Stefan Balmer wrote up to do this sort of, this so-called gravitational wave radiometer search, and the first results from this were with S4 data. There'll be results coming up soon from S5 data, which look for gravitational waves from Scorpius X1, thought of as a sort of random, nearly monochromatic source coming from that point on the sky. But the thing is, of course, that Scorpius X1 is not a random gravitational wave generator. It's a low-mass X-ray binary. So it is a compact object, which we hope is a neutron star. It could also be a black hole, in which case this whole story wouldn't work. But if it is a neutron star, then it's in orbit with a companion. It's accreting matter from that companion and giving off X-rays. And in fact, that accretion can be a source of this deformation, of this non-axisymmetric deformation. And so it should be giving off gravitational waves nearly sinusoidally. There is a breakdown from the sinusoidal signal, one, if the spin frequency were evolving, although we expect that there is a regime which you could find a low-mass X-ray binary in where these things are balanced, where you're giving off, so you're losing energy to gravitational wave radiation at exactly the rate that you're picking it up from the accretion spin-up. And so if those are balanced, then you actually wouldn't have to worry about that. But you also have the fact that well, so there's some argument for that. So there was this paper by Lars Biltzen back in the 90s that argued that that may be why we don't see neutron stars spinning too fast. So there seems to be a sort of a frequency of sort of several hundred hertz beyond which there aren't neutron stars in binary systems spinning. And so maybe what happens is if they spin too fast, then they give off, then they sort of spin themselves back down by gravitational radiation. And so maybe the reason why they don't get arbitrarily spun off by this accretion is that. And so if that balance happens in the LIGO frequency band, it actually should give off gravitational radiation, which you would expect to detect with advanced LIGO. So that's why a bunch of us are interested in coming up with the best SCOX1 searches for advanced LIGO. I had mentioned this actually when I drew the sort of cartoon gravitational wave generator with the binary system, and I said, well, you know, the rotating neutron star is the same thing. It's just some sort of oscillating quadrupole moment. Yes.
How far is the observed bound spin rate below the the rate at which it would spin itself apart?
So I am not a neutron star astrophysics expert, but I don't think that I don't think that's in that regime.
What did you say with the what is the observed?
I mean, neutron stars are pretty compact, right?
But what is the observed upper bound of those?
I actually don't know that off the top of my head what that is, but it's something. I mean, there are millisecond pulsars, but I think that's a different example. But I think it's somewhere in the sort of a bunch of hundreds of hertz, like 600 hertz. But that's so I'm pulling that number out of my hat. Okay, so we got several slides ahead of ourselves. I wanted to at least sort of spell out the modification in the method, which actually is not specific to low-mass X-ray binaries, but the modification of the method to take advantage of the fact that you may be looking for a rotating neutron star with unknown rotation properties as opposed to a superposition of incoherent signals. And in fact, actually, so not only is the stochastic search not using all the information, but it's making kind of a false assumption about what the gravitational waves look like. It's making an assumption that you have sort of equal amounts of radiation in the plus and cross polarization, however you define them. And that won't be the case in the case of a rotating neutron star, because here, you know, there is a single signal. It's not a superposition of a bunch of different signals. It's a single signal. It's got some unknown orientation of its spin axis, and so it's got some unknown preferred polarization angle psi in this basis, and it's also got some unknown inclination angle for the rotation, which, and that determines, as we saw in these, again, in these cartoons, how much plus and cross polarization there is. That if you're seeing it face on, there's equal amounts of plus and cross polarization, so these amplitudes are the same if cosine iota is 1, and if you're seeing it edge on, then there's no cross polarization. And so there's this information about, there's this amplitude information, but there's also some frequency information. As I said, if there were no spin down, then this phi would just be, 2 pi f times the time, but it would be the time in the rest frame of the neutron star. And in particular, it wouldn't be in the time in the rest frame of the detector. And so you have to worry about Doppler modulation from the waves hitting the different detectors at different times, and that changing as the Earth rotates and goes around the sun. And so it actually means that the frequency at which you expect to see the signal in each detector is very slightly Doppler modulated. And so the information that's not in the stochastic search, which we can build into a continuous wave cross-correlation search, is what frequencies to try to look for correlations at. So if you have a Doppler shift in each detector, you could expect that you'd get the best correlation by correlating this frequency in one detector with this frequency in another detector, because they could be, if you know what direction the signal is coming from, you know what the Doppler shift of these things is relative to each other. Additionally, if the signal model really is this simple, we don't just have to take data at the same time, which is done in the stochastic search. We can correlate data taken at different times, and so that enables you to basically use more of the data and improve the sensitivity that way. And so the technique basically says that we're looking for a correlation. Now this is no longer a random signal. This is some signal that has unknown parameters. And we're also looking for correlation at different frequencies. And so there are some modifications that basically you go through the same optimal filter technique, only instead of the overlap reduction function, you've got this geometrical thing which is tailored to the continuous wave signal. The reason why they got away with this in the stochastic search is that they had a low enough frequency resolution that the Doppler modulation didn't matter. So this is a useful back-of-the-envelope thing to do. If you think about the Doppler shift from the Earth's rotation and the Earth's orbit, you see that the maximum possible Doppler shift that you can get relative to the frequency that you'd observe at the solar system barycenter, so relative to some sort of un-Doppler shifted frequency, that is about 10 to the minus 4. And so at 2 kilohertz, that would give you something of sort of 0.2 hertz, would be sort of where you'd expect it to be shifted. And so if you're trying to add up power in a particular frequency bin, you don't want to have the frequency bin be smaller than about 0.2 hertz, because at your high frequencies, you would basically have your signal would move in and out of the bin as the Earth went around the sun. So different times of the year, you'd be seeing your cross-correlation signal in different bins. And so the stochastic search combines their bins in such a way that they count up the signal in bins that are a quarter of a hertz wide. So even at 2 kilohertz, this would have picked up all the signal in basically the same bin. And at lower frequency, unless it was close to the edge or something. But you would expect that it would not scatter the signal across several bins. There's also a problem that you're looking for cross-correlation. And so, you have much more of a problem if you think about how fine your Fourier transforms are. And if you're constantly multiplying bins at which there's, signal with bins at which there's no signal because you haven't Doppler shifted them, then you just wouldn't have any signal to add up. And there, you're looking at correlations between different detectors. And so there, what really matters is what is the Doppler shift between the two detectors. And so that's where the Earth's rotation matters, right? So if you think about it, if you're taking simultaneous data, as the Earth goes around the sun, you may have the signal in Hanford and the signal in Livingston be Doppler shifted by you know, a tenth of a hertz, but it's going to be Doppler shifted the same way in both detectors. And so you know, that won't cause a problem with the cross correlation. It might cause a problem with adding the things up wrong. However, you have to worry about the rotational motion Doppler shift, because it's going to mean that you'll have the Earth's rotation. Yeah. So yeah, spin of the Earth, and so that's going to mean that you're going to get different Doppler shifts in the two detectors, and so there you would just be not correlating the right data. And so the Fourier transforms, for example, in the S4 search, they used 2-minute SF, so 2-minute Fourier transforms, and so they had a resolution of about 10 to the minus 3 hertz. And again, we see that the maximum Doppler shift due to the rotation, which could be different at the different detectors, that's like 3 times 10 to the minus 3 hertz. And so, again, we see that we don't expect to Doppler shift the data, the signal contributions into different frequency bins of the Fourier transform from the two detectors. So basically, this search didn't take advantage of data at different times, and it didn't allow them to get a finer search in frequency. But it, within the parameters of the search that was done, because the frequency bins were coarse enough, they didn't have to worry about the signal model. So, if you want to. Well, that's the maximum.
Y2 is the peak amplitude or the flying, right? Anyway, you slice it, it looks like it's about an order of 1 loss.
At the highest frequency that so this is if you're looking at 2 kilohertz. Yeah. So I guess at lower frequencies, this is less, and you know this. So yeah, I suppose if you're saying, you know, what is it now versus what is this in 6 months, but if you want to just get a scale as to like, are you just totally losing everything? You know, if you were Doppler shifting by 10 bins, then you just wouldn't want to do it this way. So let's see, I think we don't really have time to go into why you want to do these semi-coherent searches and you know, why you wouldn't just do a fully coherent search for the signal at every point in the parameter space.
That was going to be my question.
We can save that for the, because I think by any definition we're at the end of the question time, because we did only start only 10 minutes late. So let me just do the advertisements. Find the slides that have the paper citations on them, right? So the original methods paper was something that Bobby Kundar and a student a few years ago in general, and Christine Chung, who is a grad student at Melbourne, who's just recently got a PhD on applying this to a particular sort of signal, which is to look for a signal in a supernova 1987A remnant. So we expect that there should be a young neutron star there because we know there was a supernova there recently. Again, there's some things that I don't have time to go into about how you would want to look for what parameters you want to search over to find that. And so that's something which Christine wrote up in her dissertation. And we've also got a methods paper with her advisor, Andrew Malatos, and Bodri and I, which will be in monthly notices soon and is on the archive now.
So 15 kiloparsecs, is it a long distance for this parameterable source, or is it so short?
It's pretty long. You know, you normally only expect to be looking for things in the galaxy, right? So even looking at the galactic center is kind of far away. If there were a known pulsar there, then we could do a much deeper search. Yes, it's a bit. Because it's so young, there, you know, anything could have been happening for the last 10 years, and so it's our last, it's 1987, I did the math here, what is it now? This number changed, right? Like when they started, we started in S5, this was 18 years old, I guess, and
24.
Now it's 24, yeah, and so it's and it's funny because like, I think the Methods paper refers to the age base limit based on if it had been sort of spinning down like crazy since 1987, and then sort of the level of that limit changes on the timescale of papers. But this is at least the indirect age base limit that was set in the context of S5. So I think I'll skip ahead to my summary slide, which has almost exclusively bullet points from parts of the talk that I skipped. So it's a pretty quick summary. So I think as I warned, this is mostly a talk on gravitational waves, as it turned out. A terrible ending talk, so I always just sort of fall off.
So then why, so my point is, I have probably more questions. First one though, so I know all sky pulsar searches, fully coherent pulsar searches are basically impossible. Or very...
Right, or you have to use very short, yeah, so okay, I'll put this up, so in fact...
But I guess what I was getting, obviously you do have this, because what I was getting at obviously is this...
Fully coherent means you what's the fully coherent? Fully coherent means template.
So fully coherent basically means that you are keeping track of the phase information from the first time relative to the last time. So if you think about
or semi coherent means you keep phase only over chunks of time and you sum.
Yeah, I mean we can actually in the context of cross correlation you could think of which. You know, for which things are there products of data. So if you actually work out the usual maximum likelihood statistic that's used to look for known pulsars is called the F statistic. And this is something which is sort of quadratic in the signal. And if you sort of think about, it's quadratic in this kind of vector of signals over times and instruments. And so the if you include all of the terms in that giant product, it'll have sort of, you know, things with themselves and arbitrary cross terms. And it's not exactly the same giant quadratic thing that you apply this cross correlation search that way, but it's kind of conceptually comparable. And so, you know, if you could think about it, I'm basically taking any data at any time just multiplied by any other data. And a semi-coherent way of doing this would be to say, well, we take a shorter amount of time, we do a search in there, and we get, you know, sort of a, we get an overall amplitude of signal, and we add that to an amplitude of signal at a different time. But we, you know, so it's basically, it's looking, if you, instead of looking for an amplitude in x1 plus x2, it looks, takes the amplitude in x1 plus the amplitude in x2. And so you, it means that you don't have to, since these amplitudes involve parameter space corrections that shift around, you know, and have to consider the different timestamps of the different data. What happens if you have a data at the beginning and data at the end, and you really care about the relative time between them? It means you need really, really fine, for example, frequency resolution. You know, it means that if you chose a very slightly different frequency, then your wave at the beginning would be totally out of phase with the wave at the end. And so basically what you're trying to do is get rid of resolution in parameter space, because the resolution in parameter space causes you to need too many templates. And so for just doing, this actually is an all-sky, one-spin-down search. And again, if you just think about sort of, you know, doing beats of guitar strings against each other, the longer you observe for, the more finely you resolve frequencies. And so that means that the number of templates you need in the frequency direction goes like the coherent observing time. And the number in the spin-down direction, dimensionally, you can sort of believe it goes like the time squared. And the number you need in the sky, it turns out that it goes in each sky, in each dimension on the sky, it goes like Ft. And so even just this search over sky positions and frequencies in one spin-down, the number of templates you need goes like the fifth power of the coherent observing time. Plus, you also have to analyze all the data, and so that means that you get another power of the time. And so, you know, it means that if you try to analyze, you know, three times the data, it takes 1,000 times as long. And so it means that if you want to do a fully coherent observation, it turns out that you can really only do it in a manageable way for, you know, hours of data instead of months of data.
But you don't have the sky that should be part of the scaling if you know where to look.
Yeah,
so that comes down to power, that's what I was asking. So does that make it, like, so suppose if you really want to really, really, really get this source, would it be worth devoting, like, your sources of Einstein form or something to just doing the directed search really coherently?
So the problem tends to be that there are additional parameters. So in for SCOEX 1, you have unknown parameters in the orbit, right? Or you have the orbit of SCOEX 1 is nailed down reasonably well, but there's still some residual uncertainty in the projected semi-major axis and in the orbital phase, the sort of, you know, time of periapsis passage. And so you, for SCOEX 1, even assuming you don't have to search over spin downs, you have to search over frequency, A sine I, and TP. And so, you know, there you already have a sort of three-dimensional parameter space to search over. And these are all sort of phase parameters that scale, and that scale, so the cost scales like some power observing time. And for supernova 1987A, because it's can be spin down really fast, you would potentially have to search over a bunch of spin downs. Actually, the thing that Christine worked on in her thesis was an alternative method where you're searching over sort of amplitudes in a spin down signal model. But the point is that for these kind of directed searches, targeted searches. So there's three terms, right? There's all sky searches where you just look for something you don't see. There's directed searches where you're looking for a known pulsar, so you know where it is and you know how it's rotating. And there, you don't have to search over any phase parameters. You just have to either maximize or search over the amplitude parameters, which is not expensive. So you can get the best limits for known pulsars. And there's an intermediate thing where you've got something, like CAS-A, before they figured out how CAS-PA was spinning, that was a target for one of these intermediate searches, these targeted searches, where you know there's an object there, it's probably a neutron star, but you don't know how it's rotating. So neutron star is about an associated pulsar. So supernova remnants and moments actually binaries are the obvious ones for these.
Are these techniques applied to some other exotic searches? You're applying it to gravitational waves, but it sounds like a generic enough thing that you can do, right? You have two detectors relatively separated in some fluids.
So I would imagine that you're asking the converse question, which is that hasn't somebody already invented this wheel?
Well, somebody must have thought in that direction, right? No, I'm not saying your work is done by me.
Well, there's been plenty of work done I think gravitational waves is not the only field, but there certainly have been a lot of instances where, you know, we've rediscovered things that people already knew from general signal processing. There are a few things that are specific here in terms of the geometry of the orbit, and it seems like there's some things that are specific to the way that gravitational wave signals get created. But maybe it's just a matter of, you know, sort of spin one versus spin two, or, you know, the pi periodicity versus two pi periodicity kind of thing. I know that this has been used in the other direction, though. One of the ways to do an all-sky search, one of the current all-sky searches done in LIGO is a semi-coherent search that's done by distributed computing, called Einstein at Home, which everyone should download and install as their screensaver. It's a thing that runs in the background and uses the spare cycles of your computer to fetch LIGO or Virgo or GEO data and do a search for gravitational waves coming from a particular point in parameter space on it.
And so that's been used to do an all-sky detection search with initial gravitational wave detector data. But they started something more recently where some fraction of the cycles are actually spent looking through Arecibo data. And they've detected a couple of previously unknown pulsars in Arecibo data by doing sort of very similar types of computations of looking for Doppler modulated signals from a particular direction. They've also the first thing they did, which was encouraging, was rediscover a bunch of pulsars that were already known. But then they got to the point where there have been, I think, two detections announced of previously unknown pulsars that were detected by Einstein at home, not in gravitational wave data, but in radio data.
Yes. All right.